Growing up in a household that listened almost exclusively to classical music, I had scant exposure to what was currently popular. Sure, the occasional Beatles tune would sneak through the defenses, and my mom had a Carpenter record that she really liked, but for the most part, I had a strictly classical upbringing. And I enjoyed classical music, and still do, but I was pretty sure there was more to music than a bunch of dead white European men. Not that there was much evidence to the contrary. When I was 7, my mother moved the two of us to the woods of northern Michigan so she could take a job at the Interlochen Arts Academy as the resident ballet instructor. It was a job she wasn't entirely qualified to take, having the ballet bug implanted in her by a chance screening of The Red Shoes when she was a little girl. She devoted her life to becoming a ballerina and had taken thousands of hours of classes, but had never taught any of them. Still, she knew more about it than those who hired her, and so she got the job and turned out to be more than capable, soon running the department and staying on for over a decade. Interlochen was a strange place. An island of so-called culture in the vast, empty North Woods. But the culture they taught and revered was of a classic European style. The boarding high school also had an intensive college preparatory academics program, but all the areas of study remained as they had been codified by the school's founder, the visionary Dr. Joseph E. Maddy, who founded the National Music Camp, an intensive 8-week summer program, at Interlochen in the 1930s. Out of that popular and famous program grew the Arts Academy, opened in the 1960s to a much smaller group of boarding high school students. The academy usually had between 300 and 400 students, while the music camp accommodated thousands of students from age 7 through college and beyond. But, consciously or not, the programs of study rarely ventured out of the 1930s definitions. There were 5 general areas of artistic expression that were taught, and by extension, validated: music, visual arts, theater, dance, and creative writing. There was no film or video department. The dance department taught ballet and modern, the latter sometimes begrudgingly, but that was it. Occasionally, a jazz dance guest teacher would pass through, but it wasn't considered part of the core curriculum, even though that's ultimately where most of the dancing jobs are. Although both the academy and the music camp had killer jazz bands, the focus was clearly on classical music. Popular music, as it was practiced after the 1950s, that is, rock and roll, was universally ignored, if not reviled, so although I knew there was such a thing out there, I never really got to hear any of it. In 8th grade, after I had started forging my own trails in music appreciation, almost all of which were symphonic synthesizer albums by the like of Synergy, Tangerine Dream, and Vangelis, I decided to find out what this rock music that my peers seemed to enjoy so much was all about. The trouble was how to get any of it. For some reason, I rejected out of hand the primal source of popular music that has instructed millions, if not billions, of kids on the standards and practices of rock, the radio. It wasn't that there weren't popular music stations around, it just never really occurred to me to explore them. In our house, the radio meant classical WIAA, with a transmission tower a literal stone's throw from my backyard. When, a year or two later, I did start to listen to the radio, I discovered that my instincts were mostly right. It was largely a vast wasteland of crap and drivel. I didn't have money to spend on albums, or singles even, and more importantly, I had no idea where to begin. Being an only child, I had no older siblings whose collection I could peruse, so I had to borrow somebody else's older sibling. And that someone I chose was Melissa, one of my friend Mel's 4 or 5 older sisters. Being that Interlaken was such a small town, one's choice of friends was pretty limited. I was very lucky to have three great people my age who lived within easy walking distance of my house. Lenore, who was in my class at the local elementary school, and her brother Carl, a year younger, were the kids of the academy's German teacher. Does anybody teach high school German anymore? They lived in faculty housing about a block from my house, and we became great friends. But Lenore was the oldest of four in that family, and knew as little about rock as I did, so that wasn't particularly helpful. My other best friend, Mel, who was also in my elementary school class, lived in the other direction, through the state park, also an easy walk through the woods. There were a couple of other kids our age around that we were friendly with, but the four of us were largely inseparable for quite a few years, from the time I moved into the neighborhood in fourth grade until halfway through high school, when I moved into the dorms at the academy and made a whole new set of friends. Carl and Lenore and I were all faculty brats, attached to the academy, but Mel was a local, a subtle but significant distinction. For although we were all locals to some degree, the faculty brats inhabited the rarefied air of the academy bubble, which stood in direct contrast to the real local community. We were in the community, but not of it, and although that distinction was largely lost on us as children, it became more palpable as we grew older. At any rate, Mel, short for Melody, although she'd beat the crap out of you if you called her that, was the youngest of five or six girls. I never could keep a straight count. And youngest by quite a stretch. Her nearest sibling, Melissa, was several years older than her, and her other sisters had already left home, or were in the process of leaving. In one of those strange family quirks, all of the members of that family had names that begin with M. Melody, Melissa, Mary, Martha, Maureen, maybe a couple more. And if you wanted to stretch the point, Mr., Mom, and the two dogs, Mindy and Magic. When I was around, only Mary and Melissa were still in the house, and Mary was pretty unapproachable. So I went to Melissa and asked if she would be so kind as to let me borrow a couple of records so I could hear what this rock stuff was all about. She carefully considered my request and dug through her collection and let me borrow three records that would serve as an appropriate introduction to the wondrous and exciting world of rock and roll. Foreigner's first album, the Peter Criss solo album, and Nazareth's greatest hits. Right away, I understood what was so appealing about this music. The beat, the beat, the beat. By this point, having listened to synthesizer music for a while, my ears had become accustomed to electronic sounds, so the textures of the electric guitars didn't scare me as much as they used to. And a lot of the screaming seemed unnecessary, but kind of cathartic for my blossoming teenage angst. But it was the incessant thumping heartbeat and splashing cymbals that really caught my attention. The marriage of those two strong attractors, the sonic possibilities of electronic synthesis and the tribal explosion of drums, was still a few years away, so I contented myself with buying that which I truly loved, synthesizer music, and getting my rock fix by slowly borrowing my way through Melissa's recommendations, from the Sublime, the Cars, to the Ridiculous. It wasn't until a little more than a year later, when I'd left the local junior high to start taking classes at the academy, that I heard a rock record I liked so much that I had to have it for my own. I was a freshman, by far the smallest class in the school. There were 10 times as many seniors as there were freshmen. And I had started taking acting classes, although I wasn't very good, to put it charitably. But I was good at and interested in theater tech, so I spent a lot of time hanging lights and painting sets and whatnot for the many theater and dance productions that took place throughout the year. One day, I was up on a ladder at Gruno Theater, the rat-infested tinderbox that the drama geeks called home, focusing lights and adjusting gels, while other techies moved sets around and adjusted the seating. As was usual, somebody brought a tape deck so we'd have music to listen to while we did our work. The music that came out of the box was unimpressive and forgettable. Drama geeks, as if they weren't annoying enough on their own, and they are, had a mind-boggling penchant for show tunes.
One. Singular sensation, every little step she takes.
Like most of what I heard those days, it just rolled right off of me, in one ear and out the other. But then somebody put in a tape that caught my attention. The band had all the power that I was learning to appreciate in rock, but it was a lot more polished than what I usually heard. And the music itself was considerably more sophisticated, almost classical in its construction. On top of all that, the electric guitars had a heroic, soaring quality, and the whole effect was incredibly uplifting and optimistic, almost mythic in scale. After a couple of songs, I shimmied down the ladder to see what was playing. It was Boston. As soon as I scraped together a little money, I went into town. Traverse City, 20 miles away, was the closest thing we had to civilization up there, and it wasn't that close, and bought my two first rock albums, the first Boston album and the first Peter Gabriel solo album. In truth, it was probably the fact that I bought the Peter Gabriel at the same time as Boston that kept me from drowning in the glossy guitar hero pop rock river that was claiming so many of my friends. Although putatively a band, and one with something like four guitar players, Boston was the brainchild of Tom Scholz, an engineer and guitarist who invented a device called the Rockman that gave the electric guitar the clean and warm soaring sound evident on the album. Working by himself, he constructed most of the tracks on the album, then got a singer to come in and lay down those falsetto vocals that were inexplicably the rage in the 1970s. The 12-track demos were so great that he got immediate interest from a label. He assembled a band and did some re-recording, But what was released was largely the demos he had painstakingly constructed in his basement studio. Well, I'm taking my time, I'm just moving on. The album was released and immediately took the world by storm, setting a record for fastest selling debut and eventually moving almost 20 million units, catapulting them from unknown to arena headliners overnight. The album starts with the hit More Than a Feeling, a love song of sorts to the power of music and the memory of a summer love. More Than a Feeling utilizes an unusual conceit. The fade-out at the end of a song is an overused cliché and musical cheat. How do they do it live? But More Than a Feeling utilizes a fade-in to the track already in progress. It's an odd way to start a song, equally artificial as the fade out, and just as impossible to pull off live, but it does help the mythic sheen of the album, sounding like the sun rising on a brand new day, or like a parade approaching from the distance. The same effect has been used on a couple of other albums, like U2's planet-swallowing Joshua Tree album, or Beethoven's Ninth Symphony for that matter, but it's still quite unusual. More Than a Feeling perfectly encapsulates the band's sound, with its interplay between clean acoustic guitars and even cleaner electric guitars, its obsessively layered production, its soaring orgasmic chorus, and its stratospheric vocals. This album in general, and More Than a Feeling in particular, almost single-handedly created the arena rock genre, and saved hard rock from the disco doldrums it was slogging through in the mid-1970s. Not only that, but Kurt Cobain once admitted that Nirvana's breakout song, Smells Like Teen Spirit, the track that kicked open the doors of grunge, was based in part on More Than a Feeling. If you doubt me, listen to the chorus of both songs, and you'll hear an eerie similarity. The rest of the album is just as strong, or nearly so. I would be perfectly happy if the album ended after the second track on side two. Remember when albums had sides? And we didn't have to wade through Hitch a Ride, Something About You, and Let Me Take You Home Tonight. But I usually stop listening at this point anyway. I'm really kinda shy. The first side is absolutely flawless, and the first two songs on side two are right in line, ending with the scorching Smoking. Not only does it lyrically invite the listener to light up with my favorite recreational drug, but the music practically begs it as well, with the extended, almost baroque middle instrumental section featuring faux harpsichord and noodly organ pyrotechnics over a driving rhythm guitar section, exploding into swirls and screeches of electronics, stopping on a dime, and then kicking into overdrive for a, you'll have to excuse me, smoking ending. No wonder everything on the album after this track feels anticlimactic. For me, the best track on the album is the last track on side one, or rather, the last two tracks, Foreplay and Long Time. Like the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and A Little Help from My Friends, or XTC's Summer Cauldron and Grass, or even Pink Floyd's Time and Breathe Reprise, Foreplay and Long Time are separate songs in title only. The two will forever be played together because of the way they married on the album. Foreplay is the most classical sounding piece on the album, a beautifully wrought, virtuosic instrumental full of sound and fury and, well, you know the rest. Somewhat reminiscent of Bach's famous Toccata and Fugue, the piece marries intricate organ lines with fire-breathing guitars and thundering drums and crashing cymbals. For all that's going on in the track, it's remarkably clear. That's one of the hallmarks of Tom Scholz's sound. He can load seemingly thousands of overdubs and harmonies onto a track and never let it sound swampy. A couple of years after my discovery of this album, Mel and I went to catch a movie at the local drive-in. We were sitting in the car, chatting and listening to the radio and waiting for the sun to go down, when Foreplay came on. She wasn't really listening, so when I enthused that I love Foreplay, she shot me a peculiar look. I let her sit for an uncomfortable moment before pointing out that that's what was on the radio, and a strange mixture of uncertain relief and disappointment crossed her face. Since Mel and Carl and Lenore and I had all recently stumbled out of the certainty of childhood into the murky waters of puberty, a lot of this kind of innuendo was floating around. For example, in the halls of our junior high, Mel once yelled at me, "Hey, want a screw?" And I spun around, along with 100 of my startled classmates, to see her grinning and holding a screw between her thumb and forefinger. It was funny, these little jokes, but it was also somewhat unsettling. Hormones were twisting our relationships all out of shape and suddenly making us all question things that we had previously not even considered. Unfortunately, the strain it put on our relationships started fraying it around the edges, and when I abandoned them for the academy, they came unraveled for good.